Well, hello, good morning, everybody. We are still under quarantine. We are still under shelter-in-place orders, which I think is kind of an ironic name because, like, you have to shelter in place. Like, that's one of the essential parts of sheltering is that you are in place. Like, nobody thinks they're sheltering if they're, like, running around in a field, like, with their waving their arms over their head. Like, part of sheltering is being in place. So I think shelter-in-place is a little redundant, but we are sheltering in place. We are seeking and striving to stop spreading the sickness, which is coronavirus. We are trying to do our patriotic duty by sitting at home and watching Netflix. We are all great Americans, but in the course of our duties as true patriots and defenders of the fatherland, we are hopefully all enjoying some extra time in the Word of God. We do have the time now, unless you have small children at home, and now you have less time than ever. But if you don't have small children at home, you have more time than ever. You've got time to devote to studying the Word of God. And so that's what I'm hoping that we get out of this, is we spend some time together every single day, and we study God's Word together, and we gain, and we grow, and we become more of what Christ would have us to be. So this morning, we are going to go to Genesis chapter 37. So once again, as always, go to your favorite Bible studying resource, whether that be a study Bible that you have, whether it be an unmarked text of the Bible that you have. I really recommend, though, having a good study Bible. I've said it before, I'll say it again, I will probably never stop saying it. The most underutilized resource that the Christian church has are the study Bibles. They are really good. Excellent scholars make these things, and we really need to do a better job of using them. That's Josiah. I'm holding him on my lap while I do these, while Emily has an appointment. So if you hear Josiah kind of whimpering and whining, you know, bear with me. He's just a little bit of a fuss bucket this morning. So anyways, turn to your Bible, go to Genesis chapter 38. If I said 37, I misspoke. Go to Genesis chapter 38, Genesis chapter 38. And if you have not read the text, now is the time to do it. Go ahead and pause the text or pause this audio, and then go ahead and read the text. So, you've had your chance here. This is your last chance. Go ahead and pause the text if you'd like, if you want to read it. But otherwise, we're going to dive right into what we got going on here. So, looking at our text, we're going to go through the five W's, and we're going to move rather hurriedly through the five W's this morning because this is a story that warrants all the explanation we can possibly give it, right? This is, if you hadn't read this story before, and if for some reason you haven't heard this story before, and this is a new story to you, this is a new thing in the Bible for you, you're probably thinking, oh my gosh, I did not know the Bible was that kind of book, you know, like, oh, you know, do you have to be over 18 to buy the Bible? You know, I mean, maybe you're wondering, okay, this is an interesting story. This is kind of weird though. Yeah, this is definitely one of those stories that really stands out as being, maybe uniquely awful. That might be the way to describe it. This is a uniquely awful story in the Bible. Not awful because it's badly told, but awful in the sense of the moral issues that are going on in this story by pretty much everybody. Nobody comes off looking good in this story. So yeah, let's look at this uniquely terrible story in the Bible, and maybe gain some insight and some wisdom out of it. So first of all, we'll do the first of our W's. Who is this story about? Well, we could go through, like I said, we could go through and we could name all of the names. You know, if you wanted to, you could go through and highlight these with a marker probably a highlighter, probably not a Sharpie. That wouldn't really do you a whole lot of good. You'd want to use a highlighter, but you could use different colors if you wanted to highlight different aspects of the text. But if we go through and we want to know our who's. Okay, so first of all, who are we looking at in the story? Well, we have Judah, we have his brothers, we have an Adullamite man named Hira, we have the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua, we have this girl, she gives birth to sons for Judah named Ur and Onan and Shelah, and Judah gets a wife for his son Ur, his firstborn, named Tamar. Anyways, we'll continue, and we're looking at the names, and you know, we've got these people. We have basically just, you know, if you're scanning through the text along with me, you know, we get to about chapter or about verse 12, and we see that we still really have just those people. We have Judah, Hira the Adullamite, Shua, Judah. Tamar, Onan, and Shelah, okay, or Shelah, depending on how you want to pronounce that, okay. And then we look and we see, do we have any more names? Oh, well, we've got this prostitute. Although the text does tell us that that's Tamar. Tamar is the prostitute, okay. So, and then we look through. Do we have any other people? Well, we've got people of the town. We've got a midwife. And we've got two little boys, Perez and Zira. Okay, so those are our who's. Okay, those are our who's. Now, we already know who Judah is. Most of these other people are brand new characters. They are new to this story, beginning in this story. There's an introduction of a lot of characters here. Judah is really the only and his brothers. Judah and his brothers are the only ones that we haven't known so far. Okay, so when does this happen? Now, we don't know exactly when this happens. We just know that it's at this time. At that time. Well, what's at that time? Well, at that time takes us back to chapter 37. Okay, so 37 tells us that it tells us about Joseph and Joseph's dreams and Joseph being sold to slavery in Egypt. And then, as we know, then Joseph, when he's in slavery in Egypt in Potiphar's house, he refuses to have sex with his mistress, with the wife of Potiphar, and she will falsely, this is future, this is in chapter 37, but she will falsely accuse him of rape. Joseph will be thrown in prison, in the dungeon, and he will languish there until he is called by Pharaoh. So right now, where we are in the story is shortly after, or sometime around the time when Joseph has been sold into slavery in Egypt, and he's gotten to Egypt, and he's now in the house of Potiphar as a slave there. So the story continues. So when is this happening? Well, this is happening around the time that Joseph is sold into slavery. Now, the interesting thing is, we see that this is covering a pretty large span of time. Okay, this is a fairly decent span of time. Judah has a son, okay? He has a son, and his son is named Ur, okay? Now he has a son named Ur, and Ur grows old enough to have a child, okay? He gets married, he has a child, and he has three kids, and Ur, his firstborn, is old enough to get married to Tamar, and then die, and then for his younger son to get married and die, and then for his third son to come of marriageable age and not be ready to be married. So we're looking probably at a minimum, I mean a bare scraping the bottom of the barrel, minimum of 20 years for this to happen. About 20 years for this to happen. So this is a significant period of time. All right? So what do we do with this? What do we do with this long passage of time, and how does that correspond with the time that Joseph is in Egypt? That's a really good question, Luke. So why don't we take a quick break, and let's look at some other passages of Scripture and see how that kind of lines up, how that lines up time-wise. Well, if we go back to Genesis chapter 37, if we just go back a previous chapter, we find out that Joseph was 17 when he was sold into slavery by his brothers. Now, if we were to go forward to Genesis chapter 41, we find out that Joseph was 30 years old when he became second in command to Pharaoh. Then we know that there were at least 7 years of plenty. Okay, so first of all, we've got 17 when he goes to Egypt, 30 when he enters Pharaoh's service. So that's roughly 13 years, probably a little bit less, but about 13 years. So probably like 12 years and some months. Then we have 7 good years. Now, do the 7 good years begin immediately upon Joseph being, you know, becoming prime minister? I don't know. Is there a year or two interval? We assume not, but there could have been. but just for the sake of saying not, let's just say that there wasn't, and that there are 7 good years. So now we're looking at 19, 19 years and some months, to 20 years exactly, somewhere around there. I mean, if Joseph was taken on his birthday, he became prime minister on his birthday, and the famine began. The years of plenty began exactly that day on his birthday, then we're looking at a period of exactly 20 years. And then we have the time of the famine. So how long was the famine by the time that the Israelites actually got to the land of Canaan, by the time that Joseph had revealed himself to his brothers? Well, that's, again, not a very difficult piece of math. If we go and we turn in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 45, Genesis chapter 45 specifically, verse 11, again, we see that there are still 5 years of the famine left to go. So we've had 7 good years plus 2 bad years because there are 5 years of the famine left. So that gives us a period of a maximum period of about 22 years, unless we want to say that the famine didn't begin immediately upon Joseph taking his throne. Maybe there was a year or two interval before that happened. We don't know that. We can't impute that into the text. But here's what that means. If we take that Judah was there, that he hadn't moved away until after Joseph was sold into slavery, that immediately after that he goes, and immediately after that he finds a wife, give a year for him to find a wife after he moves, and then another year for her to get pregnant. That's 2 years. That means that if his oldest son was 17, then we've got a period that works. I mean, this is a tight time schedule. This is a tight time schedule for all of his sons to have grown to maturity and been marriageable age and for them to have died. So this is when we look at the story of Judah, and we look at the story of Judah and Tamar specifically, and Judah's sons, these are young men. These are boys, okay? When Ur marries Tamar, and he was a wicked man and God killed him, Ur is probably 17. I mean, timeline-wise, he's probably a maximum of 17 or 18 years old. A maximum of 17 or 18 years old. And God is striking him dead. Because all of this happens before they go to live in Egypt. So this all has to occur within a maximum of a 22-year timeline. And obviously, you have to have lengths of time, at least for that initial pregnancy, because you can have overlap otherwise, but you have to have that initial time of pregnancy for right? So even if the boys were born only 1 year apart, you got a whole group of Irish twins, right? And so Ur gets married as soon as he's of a marriageable age. So we're looking at, I mean, I'm using 17 as a number, but I mean, maybe we could push that back to 16, maybe. But all of this is happening with Judah and Tamar. This is happening right on the heels of their reunion with their brother. Okay, so the timeline is important. The timeline works, but the timeline tells us that this is pretty tight. Okay, Judah is doing what he's doing, and this is happening in a pretty close time schedule to when they're going to return to Egypt. Now, so we have our who, our when, or where is this story happening? Well, the story is happening in Canaan land. This is happening there in the Promised Land. Joseph, now we've got a split story. Joseph is in Egypt, but his family is there in Canaan. So we have our who, our where, our when, and our what. Now, our what is the kind of the icky part of this story, right? This is the story that has led to a lot of, how should I put it? Just a lot of weird beliefs out there. Okay, so this is we're going to go through the text, and again, this is one of those places where if you want to get practice writing one of your plot diagrams, remember it's that weird upside down checkmark thing where you have your low end on your left, your high point about three quarters to two thirds of the way across your paper, heading towards your right, and then you have a quick drop down. You've got that upside down check mark. That's your plot line. That you have your rising action, your climax, and your falling action. Right? It's a really useful tool to help understand what's going on and to understand what God is trying to communicate through the text. Because God tells a story really well, because God is the inventor of all stories, because he is the creator of the universe, right? So God knows how to inspire Moses to tell a good story here. And we should view every one of these sections, every one of these pericopes, we should be trying to understand how each of them work, as not only how do they work within the overall scope of the scriptures, but how they work individually as a narrative. That those are important to understand. It's important to understand each little section, each pericope, as its own unit, as its own gift to the people of God. It is its own story. It's its own thing. Now, yes, obviously, it necessarily is part of a bigger story. That's why it's a chapter and not a book, right? It's a part of the overall story, but each one contributes its own message. It gives its own vision of the world. It gives its own presentation of the way that God would have the world to be and how we can be in God's will. Okay, so you can do your plot chart if you want, but so we have at that time Judah left his brothers. Okay, so we've got slight rising action because Judah's clearly not too pleased with what's happened with Joseph. So he goes and he stays with another guy. He sees the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. He acquires her as a wife. He sleeps with her. She becomes pregnant. She has a son. Judah named him Ur. She became pregnant again, had another son, named him Onan. She had yet another son, whom she named Shelah, and she gave birth to him in Kizib. Okay, so far, I mean, really pretty flat plot line. I mean, yeah, he's having kids, but, you know, it's not really exciting. It's just kind of a narrative. It's a genealogy so far, okay? Judah acquired a wife for Ur, his firstborn. Okay, boring. This is just more genealogy. Maybe we want to skim this part, right? Because we all skim the genealogies, right? Let's be honest. We all skim the genealogies. Oh, but whenever we see but, we should always pay a little bit closer attention, because it's telling us that what we're assuming is going to happen is not what's going to happen. That's what but tells you. But says, I know you have preconceived notions about how this story is going to go. I'm telling you that your preconceived notions are wrong in this instance. Now, maybe your preconceived notions are right, generally, but they're wrong this time. That's why we have but. Whenever we see but, we need to stop and pause and say, oh, what was I expecting, and how is the story telling us something different than what I was expecting? But Judah's firstborn, was evil in Yahweh's sight, so Yahweh killed him. That's some rising action, right? I mean, that's a kind of a break from your typical genealogy story, right? Like, oh yeah, and grandpa had a son, and he got a wife for our uncle and then God killed him. What? Then Judah said to Onan, sleep with your brother's wife and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her, so that you may raise up a descendant for your brother. Okay, so this is pretty standard stuff. This is what you would expect. This was the expectation of what a brother would do for his brother if he died. If he died without having children, his brother, his next of kin, would have sex with his wife, possibly also take her on as another wife if he already had a wife, or take her on as an initial wife if she was a wife, or take her on as a concubine, or however they wanted to work that out. But he would take her on, and he would produce a child for his brother, who would inherit his brother's property. He would become like a son to Judah, right? He would fulfill that family line, okay? But Onan knew that the child would not be considered his. Ah, ha, ha, ha. So Onan, not being stupid, knows that the child won't be his, which means that he goes from being second in line and getting 25% of Judah's property, to now he's being first in line and getting 67% of Judah's property. 25% of Judah's property to 67% of Judah's property is a pretty big difference in Judah's property, right? Like, that's a 42% increase just from your brother dying. You have earned 42% more of your father's wealth. You have gained a 42% increase in your inheritance by your brother being dead. However, comma, if you have sex with your dead brother's wife, and you produce a child, you lose all of that. Okay, so now you take your total wealth, and your total wealth is 100%. Now you go, you're losing about 2/3 of your wealth. Because he's already calculating this is his. So he went from almost tripling his wealth to now he's going to go back down to having his wealth cut by 2/3. He does not want to do this. He does not want to do this. So what does he do? So whenever he slept with his brother's wife, he wasted his emission on the ground. That's what the NET says. The classical interpretation is that he spilled his seed on the ground, or the NET, their notes say that he ruined it to the ground. Okay, so why did he do this? So that his brother would not have a child. What he did was evil in the Lord's sight, so the Lord killed him too. Now, I want to pause right here. Let's pause right here. This has created a lot of weird theologies and a lot of weird but this has been part and parcel of a couple of weird theologies. First of all is Onanism. People talk about Onanism, and Onanism is an old-timey word for masturbation, and people would say that is why masturbation is a sin, because if you spill your seed on the ground and it's not directed towards producing a child, which masturbation does, that is a sin. Okay, well, that's not a good biblical argument. That is not why this was sinful. Okay, that it was sinful because he was greedy, and the text tells us why it was sinful. The text says, so as not to give his brother a descendant. What he did was evil in the Lord's sight, so the Lord killed him too. Okay, people might say, well, Luke, what was evil was that he was spilling it on his ground. His motivation was immaterial. Friends, that's not how we do good Bible study, right? If there's a detail given to us, we ought to take it that the detail is rather important. When it gives us a motivation for someone's actions, we ought to understand the motivations as being rather important. Okay. Other people would say, and this is where a lot of Catholic theology comes in, that you know, sexual intercourse is always to produce a child. You know, and there are various forms of this, and I can't tell you exactly where canon law is on this exactly right now, but it's generally believed that any kind of contraception within Catholicism is sinful, right? Why? Because of Onan, right? Or at least that's one of the arguments, is that sexual intercourse is always meant to produce a child, or at least it ought to have the capacity to create a child, right? If it doesn't have the capacity to create life, then it's bad. It's sinful. That's dumb. That's dumb. You cannot build an entire theology of human sexuality on this one passage, right? Like if you're trying to build an entire theology of human sexuality and the morality of having babies based upon chapter 38 verses 8 through 10, you're doing it wrong. Okay, that's not how good Bible study is done. That's not how good theology is done. This at best could be a minor supporting text. And I wouldn't even use it as a supporting text, because I don't think that this text has anything to do with the morality or immorality of spilling seed on the ground, so to speak, in general. Right? Like, if you want to be really literal about this, then what if you use a condom and you're not spilling it on the ground? Is that not sinful then? I mean, come on. I mean, that's the logical line you want to draw. Like, if you want to say that spilling your seed on the ground, if that's the part that was sinful, then I would say, well, then, you know, a man could spill his seed on a bed, or he could spill his seed on a pillow, or he could spill his seed in the condom, and it wouldn't be sinful. And people would say, well, that's not what the text is saying. Clearly, spilling it on the ground is a euphemism, or is, I don't know how much better that's making it, but it's a figure of speech. And I would say, sure, it's a figure of speech. But you're missing the bigger point. This is the problem, friends, with overly literal interpretations of the Bible, is that every overly literal interpretation of the Bible can be taken a little more literally, and people say, well, that's ridiculous. Well, how do you determine when it's ridiculous and when it isn't? Right? This is if you're using this text to point to sex for non-procreative purposes being sinful, you're doing Bible study wrong. Now. Sex for non-procreative purposes may be sinful. It isn't, but it may be sinful on other grounds. This text doesn't disprove that doctrine, but it certainly can't be used to prove it or support it. And certainly this text can't be used to say anything about masturbation. It can't. Masturbation may indeed be a sin. I think it is. But this text doesn't tell us that. This is, I talked about this not too long ago, friends. Just because you're correct, just because what you're saying is true, doesn't mean that your argumentation is valid. Right? Imagine I come up with this syllogism. Okay? My syllogism is, all men are mortal. Aristotle is a man. Therefore, all mortals are philosophers. Wait, what? See, that's drawing a false conclusion from the premises, right? Like, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. You can't get there from here. That you're getting a bad conclusion. You're getting a false conclusion from two correct premises because you're not following the premises. The other way is you can take a true conclusion from false premises or false steps, right? Like, maybe you could say, all men are mortal. Aristotle is a man. Therefore, Aristotle is a philosopher. And you could say, well, all three of those things are true, but that's called a non sequitur. Like, the conclusion does not stem from the premises. That's a bad syllogism. That's a bad syllogism. Just because Onan spilled his seed on the ground and God killed him doesn't mean that God killed him for spilling his seed on the ground, because spilling your seed on the ground was in and of itself the sinful act. The sinful act was him trying to deprive his brother of having a legacy. That's what was sinful. Okay, let's stop doing Bible study badly. Let's stop doing bad Bible study. Let's demand that we interpret the text correctly. Okay, I spent more time on that than I had anticipated. Well, I don't really feel bad because I feel like that was important. But anyways, let's move on. So we're in our what. Remember, we're studying who, where, what, and so we know what's happened. Okay, so God kills God kills Onan, and then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, live as a widow in your father's house until Shelah, my son, grows up. For he thought, I don't want him to die like his brother. So Tamar went and lived in his father's house. After some time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, died. And after Judah was consoled, he left for Timnah to visit his sheep shears along with his friend Hira the Adullamite. I'm reading this directly out of the text here, by the way, because it's important to get all the details. Tamar was told, look, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she removed her widow's clothes and covered herself with a veil. She wrapped herself and sat at the entrance to Enaim, which is on the way to Timnah. She did this because she saw that she had not been given to Shelah as a wife, even though he had now grown up. Again, this text, chapter 38, is really good at giving us the motivations of people's behaviors. We have three sets of motives in a row here. If we look at this in paragraph form, verses 8 through 10, verse 11, and then verses 12 through 14, all three of the characters, we are given their motivations. Onan spills the seed on the ground because he doesn't want to lose a large portion of his father's inheritance. Judah doesn't give his son to Tamar because he's given two sons to Tamar and they both dead. Right? Like, this she is the widowmaker, okay? Like, she sends people to the grave. And then Tamar dresses up like a prostitute. Why? Because she saw that she had not been given to Shelah as a wife, even though he had now grown up. So Onan doesn't want to lose an inheritance. Judah doesn't want to lose a son. Tamar doesn't want to lose a husband. Okay, she doesn't want to lose her right to have children. So when Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute because she had covered her face. Oh, yeah, clearly, right? Like, obviously that was a cultural thing, right? Like, if a woman puts on a mask for, you know, because she's a nurse for COVID-19, that does not mean she's a prostitute, right? Like, cultures are different. Just because you cover your face in today's culture does not mean you're a prostitute. Back in that day, having a veil over your face did, right? So he turned along and he said, come, I want to sleep with you. He didn't realize that it was his daughter-in-law. Now, here's my question. How did she know? How did she know that Judah would want to sleep with her? Well, there's no way to make this story good for Judah, right? Like, there's no way that he comes out of this smelling like a rose. Because what he does is pretty despicable. And it will get even more despicabler, if that's a word. Yeah, it's a word. Well, why not? What he does is despicable. It's going to get even despicabler. Why did she know that he would want to sleep with her? Well, one, his wife had died. So, I mean, yeah, that's if that's how you're grieving, right? Like, if your wife dies, this is just let me give a message to all men right now. Like, message to all men. If your wife dies and part of the grieving process is randomly sleeping with a prostitute, you've got bigger problems in your life than your grief. Okay? If that's what your grief drives you to, you're doing grief wrong. You're doing grief wrong. Okay? So anyways, so he says, I want to sleep with you. And now, again, how did Tamar know that he would want to do this? Well, she knew Judah. And I want to be careful how I say this, because I'm not 100% sure I'm right on this. So I'm just going to float this out as an idea, as a theory. I think that Tamar was probably a pretty attractive woman. And probably Judah had been giving her long stares for a while. Maybe she caught Judah's eye. She caught Judah looking at her a little longer than was maybe entirely appropriate to be looking at your daughter-in-law. Judah, by the way, Judah's not that much older than his kids. Like, Judah was a baby having babies. Judah is, like, realistically, at most, 9 years older than Joseph. And probably not even 9 years older, because he was the fourth son of Leah. Okay? So if he's the fourth son of Leah, Jacob started having kids with Leah 13 years before they left, 13 years before they left Paddan Aram. We talked about this yesterday in the story. So even if he has Reuben right away, which he didn't, okay, he didn't have Reuben right away, but even if he did, okay, that means that at most Reuben is 13 years older than Joseph, and that's not realistic. Reuben is probably at most, I don't know, probably closer to 10 or 11 years older than Joseph. Probably at most 10 or 11, maybe even less than that. Maybe 9. Okay, Judah's the fourth son, so Judah is probably, I mean, realistic number, and this is just my guess, but I mean, you can do the math yourself. Realistically, Judah's probably only 5, you know, probably 6 to 4 years older than Joseph. 6 to 4 years older. Not significantly older than Joseph. So when Judah goes and gets married, right, he's probably, I mean, 21 to 23. He's not an old man. So by the time his son, because his son has to get older and get married at a pretty young age for this timeline to work. So Judah is, I mean, maybe not even 40 at this time. Maybe not even 40. I mean, he's probably 39 to 43 years old when this story happens. Judah's, I mean, 39 to 43, you're still in your prime as a man. You're still very much in your prime. I mean, so it's not like Judah is this, you know, old wrinkled up codger, you know, he doesn't have his pants up to his nipples, you know, but, you know, sucking on his dentures. He's a man in his prime. He's a man in his prime. So he's probably got a very much active libido, right? And he's a baby having babies. So, you know, he's a man 43, you know, men 39 to 43 can actually, believe it or not, be attracted to girls that are, you know, in of marriageable age that are, you know, 16 to 20. I'm not saying that that's appropriate to look at your daughter-in-law that way. I'm just saying that's how human sexuality works. That's how the male libido works, right? So, anyways, so probably Tamar had seen Judah giving her some rather interesting looks, some interested looks, you know, noticing the natural feminine beauty. Let me just put it that way. But anyways, I guess I don't have to church it up, because the text tells us how unchurchy it was, right? So what happens? Well, he says, what do I need to do to sleep with you? And she says, well, what'll you give me? And he says, well, what do you want? And she says, well, he says, I'll send you a young goat from the flock. And she says, well, do you have a young goat from the flock right now? What are you going to give me as a pledge? And he says, well, what do you want? Well, your seal, your cord, and the staff that's in your hand. Basically, now think about this, okay? Just let's stop and take a pause. The seal, the cord, and the staff that is in your hand. Your seal is your power of attorney. He just gave a hooker the power of attorney. Friends, Judah is not thinking clearly. He just gave that woman absolute power over all of his wealth. Judah is not thinking very clearly, right? You do not give, I don't care how perverse you are, you do not give a prostitute your debit card, your bank card, your routing number, your checkbook as a pledge for a goat. That's not a thing you do. That's just not a thing you do. Especially if you're a man of reasonable wealth, which Judah seems to be. You don't do that. You don't do that if you're a man of no wealth. Like, that's just not a thing you do. Well, anyways, so he does it. Why? Because he's an idiot. I mean, he's an idiot. So he does it, and she gets pregnant by him. She leaves immediately, removes her veil, and puts on her widow's clothes. Okay, so this story is, pardon the pun, it still hasn't reached its climax yet. Okay, this story is rather interesting. We've got a very interesting plot line going on. So Judah had his friend Hira, the Adulamite, take the young goat and go find the woman. Hira can't find her. Why? Because she wasn't actually a prostitute. She was a daughter-in-law trying to get her rights to have a son by levirate marriage. Okay, so and so they go there, and he's like, hey, where's – and he goes and he asks the people. He's like, hey, where's the shrine prostitute? And they're like, there ain't no shrine prostitute here, buddy. And so he looks, and Judah's like, let her keep the stuff because otherwise he says, I don't want to be made a fool of. The interesting thing is the NET, look at the NET translation. It's significantly different from the NIV and others. It says, otherwise we will appear to be dishonest. Let her keep the things for herself. Otherwise we will appear to be dishonest. The NET says that the Hebrew text is a literal translation is that we will be contemptible. I think we will appear to be dishonest maybe might not be the best translation. I think that maybe a more literal translation is probably better here. Which is the way the NIV goes, that we will be made a laughing stock or something like that. And he's like, look, I did send the goat to her, but I couldn't find her. Again, look at Judah's thinking here. Just follow me here, okay? Because we got to modernize this story to make sure that it makes sense. He gives a hooker his credit card, his bank card, the deed to his house, the title to his boat. He gives her his checkbook, his routing number, all of his traveler's checks, all everything he has, he's just given to her because she can sign his name. Anybody you give your seal to now has legal power over your wealth. And he says, let her keep it. Otherwise, we'll be made a laughingstock. Dude, when she takes all your wealth because she has your seal, then you will be made a laughingstock. Judah is not making the best decisions here. If you can't catch that Judah is not making the best decisions, you're missing the point here. Judah is making monumentally bad decisions. And he says, I mean, by the way, after all, I did send her the goat, but you couldn't find her. That's not the point, dude. The point is, the woman you believe to be a hooker has all of your monies right now. The point is not that you're going to look like a chump because you couldn't find the goat, find her to give her the goat. The point is that she has all of your wealth. Now then, the story, again, no pun intended, still hasn't reached its climax. After 3 months, Judah was told your daughter-in-law Tamar has turned to prostitution, and as a result, she is pregnant. Oh no, she's become pregnant. Judah says, bring her out here and burn her to death. What? Wait, what? Dude, that's your response. You have had sex with this woman. Like, you're out having sex with prostitutes, and your daughter turns to prostitution or has been sexually promiscuous, depending on how you want to translate that, and you're like, burn her to death. So while they're bringing her out, she sends word to her father-in-law, I'm pregnant by the man to whom these belong. And she says, look at the seal and the cord and the staff and see if you know who they belong to. Judah recognizes them and says, he immediately flip-flops. I mean, you got to respect the man with his flip-flops here. I mean, he's not wearing socks and flip-flops. I mean, he's wearing just straight flip-flops, right? He says, she is more upright than I am because I wouldn't give to her Sheila, my son. She was, and he didn't have sex with her again. I mean, how he goes from I'm going to burn her to death to, oh yeah, I guess I did have sex with prostitutes. Maybe that would be slightly hypocritical to burn her to death. Why was this Judah's response? Did Judah really want to burn her to death? I mean, was he really that much of a hypocrite? Maybe. I tend to think it's because he was afraid of his image publicly. He was afraid of his public image. He was afraid that if he let her live, he would be dishonored. He would be shamed. Okay. When it was time for her to give birth, that's kind of the climax, and now we have falling action. When it was time for her to give birth, there were twins. While she was giving birth to one child, he put out his hand. The midwife put a scarlet thread on it, saying, this one came out first. Then he drew back his hand, and his brother came out before him, and she said, how you've broken out of the womb. So he was named Perez, and his brother comes out with the scarlet thread, and he was named Zerah. So why do we have this story? Why do we have this story? I mean, it's pretty raunchy, frankly. I mean, the Bible's not afraid to have a raunchy story, by the way. But this is kind of beyond the pale, right? Like, the people in this are behaving pretty badly. So why is this story in here? Is it because, you know, we're all secretly voyeurs and you know, we want a good sex story now and again? No, I don't think so. I think that there are a couple reasons why. So we get to our why. Why is this story in the Bible? Why does God tell us this? What are we supposed to learn? Well, I think, first of all, we look at the story of Judah and Tamar, and then we look at Joseph and Potiphar's wife. We have a story above. The story in chapter 38 is entirely about sexual immorality. Everyone is behaving badly sexually. Contrast that with Joseph. So the man who is rich and powerful behaves with a complete lack of self-control sexually. The man who is a slave controls himself. The man who is wealthy and powerful does sinful things because of his desire to maintain his public dignity. The man who is a slave is actually able to preserve his dignity, even at great personal cost, by doing what was morally upright. I think, even though the text is not, it does not hammer on it like other texts often do, I think that what we see is that there is, the statement that she is more righteous or more in the right than I am, I think that that's what we're supposed to draw from chapter 38. So much of what Judah had been doing and his children had been doing, and even Tamar, I mean, Tamar is more right. That doesn't mean she's entirely right. But Tamar is more right. Everybody in this story is trying to get theirs. They're trying to get what they want. Right? We don't know why Ur died. Ur was wicked. But Onan wanted more of the inheritance. Judah wanted to save his son Shelah's life. Tamar wanted a son. Judah wanted sex with a prostitute after his wife died. Judah wanted to maintain his public dignity after his daughter was found out for being a prostitute. Everybody wants something in this story, and everybody is going to go about getting what they want however they want to get it. No one stops to ask whether what they're doing is right. Now, I mean, Tamar is more right. She's more righteous than Judah, but she isn't exactly righteous, right? Like, there are other ways to go about asserting your rights to a husband than tricking your father-in-law to sleep with you. Like, there are better ways, probably. I mean, I'm sure, you know, if you took that to some kind of court, they could come up with an arbitration that would be satisfactory. Even if it did mean sleeping with your father-in-law. I'm not saying that would have been out of bounds in arbitration. But I am saying that everybody is overly concerned with their dignity in this story. Everybody is overly concerned with getting what they want, getting what they believe they deserve. And they're not asking the question of what's right. Contrast that with chapter 39. Chapter 38 is a foil to chapter 39. And understanding foils in the Bible is really important. It's really important to see 38 and to understand 38 and say, how does 38 illuminate chapter 39? Well, it does. Chapter 38 points out how good Joseph is. All of these people are free and have the power to act how they want, and they continue to choose sinful things. Joseph is not free, and he continues to do the right thing, even at great personal cost. Even at great personal cost. So, why is this story in the Bible? It's there to remind us of two things, I think. First of all, it's there to remind us that we don't have the right to act badly and act hypocritically by seeking our own dignity and seeking to get what we want. When we just live for our own dignity rather than what's right, and when we choose to do what we want to get what we want rather than doing what is right, we end up looking like a fool. We end up looking like a fool. Judah looks like a fool in this. Judah is a laughingstock in this. The thing that Judah wanted to avoid happens to him. He looks like a fool. He is made a laughingstock. And that's what happens when you choose to do what's expedient rather than what's right. Choosing things that are expedient rather than choosing things that are right. Choosing things that you think are going to preserve your dignity, even if they're wrong. Friends, doing the wrong thing will not preserve your dignity. Doing what is sinful in God's sight will not preserve your name in a community. You might think it will. You might think it will, but it will not. It will not. And of course, the other why reason we have this story in the scripture is because this is a foil to Joseph. And what we really should study 38 and 39 together. Those stories need to be understood and studied together. Because what we see from 38 is that when people are free, they can choose bad things. But just because you're a slave doesn't mean you can't choose to do the right thing. Just because you're a slave, just because you don't have freedom, just because you don't have wealth, just because you don't have legal agency, just because you don't have those things, doesn't mean that you are precluded, you're kept from doing what is right. Being free will not ensure that you do the right thing. Being a slave will not ensure that you do the wrong thing. Everyone is morally answerable for their behavior. I think that that's the lesson that we're supposed to draw here. Don't try to live for your dignity. Don't live for getting what you want. And you are responsible for what you do. Your circumstances and situations in your life do not justify any and every behavior you can do. Joseph, being a slave, would not have justified him sleeping with the wife of Potiphar. Judah, fearing for his son's lives, did not justify him denying Tamar her rights as a widow. Everyone is responsible to do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. And your circumstances in life will not free you from your obligation to do what is right in the eyes of the Lord. So I hope and pray that we will, despite and no matter what our circumstances in life are, that we will seek to do what is right, to seek to do what pleases God. I hope and pray we will. And I hope you'll join us again tomorrow as we continue to work through these texts of the Bible, as we continue to study the Bible together. And I pray that this has been a blessing to you. And I can't wait to join you again tomorrow morning as we go through the Bible. Thank you, and God bless.